right. Well, let's go ahead and open up to 1 Samuel chapter 9. And let's go ahead and pray. We just thank you, Father. We thank you for the opportunity to open up your word. Thank you for the beautiful weather you've blessed us with today. And just ask that each ministry that goes on here tonight would be glorifying to you. Pray that your truth would take root in people's hearts, and that would be the case here as well. In Christ's name, we praise, amen. Okay, well, we have, I don't know, for me personally, the book is getting interesting. In some ways, I think between chapter 8, what chapter 8 reveals, and then what we see come in chapter 9, it's maybe just to me becoming more clear, some of the lessons and the intent of the author that we have here in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel. We've talked about this in the past, that ultimately this relates the establishment of the king over Israel. The importance here obviously has, messianic implications as far as Jesus coming as king of the Jews. There has to be a king. And of course, the law made provision for this. Judges shows the need. And now we actually see that coming to pass. Chapter 7, we saw an overview of Samuel's ministry. We find out very quickly that he is not the subject of the book. His ministry is passed over, just with ever such brevity. And then you get to chapter 8, we discover Samuel's ultimate purpose. That's when it becomes manifested that he is to anoint the king, the messianic line. And this becomes the backdrop for Saul becoming king. This is ultimately about Israel rejecting God as being her king. And so Saul is the king that they wanted, and consequently the one that they deserved, okay, for this rejection. And in chapters 9 through 11, I've entitled this, as you can see there, Saul the Endearing King. And, as I looked at chapters 9, 10, and 11, the author presents a very lovable individual. You look at those chapters, you look at 9, 10, and 11, and you just kind of fall in love with Saul. Okay, a very endearing picture that is painted for us. I think that these chapters are designed to make us like Saul. Okay, and let me explain this. We know that this is the people's choice. Saul gets the People's Choice Award. So he is selected because he's the king that they all wanted. Okay, he's the king that they would have chosen. And so God gives them the king that they would have chosen. And it sets the reader up for the shock of his sinister dark side that slowly starts to emerge, where we see that Saul is not a man after God's own heart. Okay, which then sets the stage for David, who is a man after God's own heart. In these chapters, in chapters 9 through 11, we see he has a good heritage. Okay, we see that he has the right physique to be king. We see that he is a loyal, obedient son to his father, almost to a fault. Okay. We see the account, and again, I'm seeing here where the author is kind of endearing us to him. At points, the account that we see in our chapter today is kind of comical. And you chuckle as you read this and the kind of person that Saul is. He's courteous, he's humble, he's unassuming. And by the time we get to chapter 11, we see that initially he's a very successful leader. Okay. Again, I think these chapters are designed to kind of endear him to us and in some ways teach us the lesson that Israel had to learn. And that is, ultimately, man is not equipped. We are not equipped to make the right choice. We are not equipped. Left to ourselves, humanity would make the wrong choice here based on the wrong criteria. And He was chosen because he met all the criteria that people would have chosen, everything that made him the right choice in the eyes of man, but ultimately these things are misleading. you could have all these qualities that he's about to describe and still not be a man after God's own heart. Okay, that's what we're going to see here. You can have all these wonderful, endearing qualities and still not be a man after God's own heart. And so this chapter will, in some ways, greatly diminish your enthusiasm for democracy because you see that people really don't know how to choose their leader. And so, obviously, God's choice is better. God's choice of Saul was all about giving people what they wanted. Now, again, as I get to the end of chapter 11, I really like Saul. as I thought about that, I thought, you know, I really think that was the author's intent, is for us to really like Saul. And then when we start to see him go down, 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 we're like, whoa, wait a minute, I thought he was all this. No, he wasn't all that. He wasn't, not ultimately. Again, the issue is the heart. He wasn't a man after God's own heart. And let's see here. This section tells us a little bit about ourselves. Again, man is not equipped to make such a decisions. If you and we see this a little later, even in 1 Samuel chapter 16, this is speaking about Samuel, no less. This is after Saul has been a huge disappointment. And we see here Samuel himself. When they entered, Samuel looked at Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as a man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And so just that important lesson here. As far as, okay, judging things on a certain level, a certain criteria as they appear outwardly, and of course, God's looking at the heart. And as we go on in the book, you say, well, okay, what is a man after God's own heart? That's answered in David. So we're not going to camp on that. We're right now we're dealing with Saul, okay, and how you can have all these qualities and yet still not be a man after God's own heart. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, he built up everybody's hopes. And I feel that way after, by the time you get through these chapters, you're like, wow, okay, Saul, you're going to be it. You're going to do great. Now we know the rest of the story, okay? But if you're reading this for the first time, you think, yes, you know, this was great choice. God's given them a great king, okay? And it totally doesn't work out that way. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get into these verses. Verses 1 through 1 and 2. Who would like to read those? Vince. Okay.
1 and 2.
That's okay. So this starts actually where Saul starts out looking good is where? Well, okay, it's a little before that actually. Yeah, he comes from good stock, right? Son of Kish, mighty man of valor. Kish is a bit of a big fish in a small pond because Benjamin during the time of the judges was just decimated. You read in Judges, it's all but wiped out. We don't know exactly when that happened in that approximate 4 centuries there. But, you know, most likely it was towards the end. And, you know, the tribe had not recovered yet, okay? And that's pretty much said later in the chapter when he says, you know, I'm the least tribe here. The Benjamites were of the least tribe. But here we see that he's a mighty man of valor. And he's of Benjamin, and you say, well, okay, well, how does Benjamin endear us to him? You know, he's a bit of an underdog because he is of the least tribe here. And so, again, I think this would actually be to his plus as far as being the people's choice here. Interestingly enough, the word Saul, the name Saul, means ask, which seems to, I don't know, in my mind, fit very nicely with, well, they asked for him. They asked for a king, and here he is. And it calls him a choice and handsome man. He's easy on the eyes. Okay, that's the kind of guy he was. He was easy on the eyes. Choice is actually the idea of young, is the word there. That's how it's normally translated in the Old Testament. So he's young and handsome. And the most handsome, it says, it seems due to his, in large part, to his stature, okay? You know, when everybody was standing in the room, everybody came to about here on him, all right? Made me think, there's this image in my mind, what was it, Tom Selleck. He played in this movie, Mr. Baseball. You ever see him at the airport? He's like walking through a sea of Japanese, and he could like put his arms out, you know, and not have anybody touch his arms. And so he was one of those guys, okay? He was a Tom Selleck of his time. Everybody was like the Japanese. Any questions or thoughts on verses 1 and 2? Okay, well, verses 3 through 5, who would like to read those? Dwight. Okay, thank you. So this is our map again. I kind of zoomed in on the area that we're talking about here. Here's central Israel at this point. This was the tribal divisions at the time of Joshua. In reality, Dan never really occupied this. And by this time, Dan has actually moved, during the time of the judges, it moved way up north of the Sea of Galilee. But right here, this is Benjamin. Okay, here is Ephraim, and we don't know exactly where these places are today. We don't know their exact locations, but obviously due to the geographic location here, he's weaving between the border of Ephraim and Benjamin. He's kind of going in through this area, and what he ends up doing is he maybe comes full circle, comes back, and he ends up at Ramah. It's not mentioned by name, but Samuel's there. It's a city. It's pretty easy conclusion to say that Ramah is the city that he ends up at the end. Here we see that he is faithful and obedient to his father. And, you know, these are attributes that the world commends. You know, even the world values when a child respects his parents. We could look at, let me see here, 1 Timothy 5:8, but if anyone does not provide for his own parents, and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever. I mean, even unbelievers, you know, have that kind of respect for their parents, okay? And so I see this as actually, again, endearing him to people. Now, let me ask you this. Is obedience and loyalty to parents a good thing? Okay, sure, yes. Is it the most important thing? Okay, yes, and that's what Jesus talks about, right? He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. He makes that point that God is to be the highest. And the point I'm trying to make here is that a person could be a great follower of their parents but be a terrible follower of the Lord. So again, that criteria on the surface seems really good. Well, you know, he's honoring his parents. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that he honors the Lord, okay? Doesn't really mean that he has a heart for the Lord. Those two things could actually, you know, come in conflict with one another. A person can be, on the other hand, be a terrible follower of their parents and yet a great at following the Lord. And so that's something to remember there. That, you know, I mean, if they come in conflict, well, you know, who should we be a great follower of? Well, ultimately the Lord. So just to think about those things, these things are on the surface, again, seem positive, and they're things that I think, you know, the People's Choice Award would have gone to him, but at the same time, they're not, you know, a slam dunk, if you will, speaking upon his character here. He does say, come and let us return, or else my father will cease to be concerned about the donkeys and will be anxious for us. Again, shows that he is tremendously concerned about his father and his father's well-being. He followed his instructions to go out, but ultimately he's concerned about, you know, his father and his state of mind. Any questions or thoughts in verses 3 through 5? Okay. Who would like to read verses 6 through 9? Yes, Daryl. Okay, thank you. So a man of God in this city. We obviously, as the passage unfolds, know this is Samuel. The city is never named, but it's reasonable to think that this is Ramah. And the servant talks about going and visiting the man of God there. And Saul replies, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is gone from our sacks, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have? What does this reveal about Saul? Yeah, he's nice. He's courteous. We don't want to go there and just ask for something. No, we don't want something for nothing. We want to go there. I mean, wouldn't you like that in a king? Right? The king who says, well, no, I'm not just going to take. I want to give. You're looking at this guy and say, yeah, this is a perfect king. This is the kind of king we want. He's courteous. And so he wants to make sure that when he shows up, he brings something in exchange for the service that will be provided. Now, is there a red flag in this this dialogue between the servant and Saul?
Well, I was thinking about it. I think so. And the reason is because he doesn't see that Saul knows that he's a man of God. He's unaware of saying,
yeah. Yeah, I would agree. The servant knows. So obviously his household is not ignorant of this reality, except for Saul. That is just a hint that there might be something wrong here. That here is the recognized leader of Israel, okay, who has judged Israel now for decades. And done so, okay, he has done so in Benjamin. Remember that he used to go, Samuel would go on circuit down here to Gilgal. He would come up to Mizpah. What was it? Kiriath-Jearim, I think, was the other place. And then he'd come back to Ramah. So here he is making a circle here. And he has no clue who Samuel is. That's not a good indication. Okay. Let me zip through these again and get back to where I was. So let me just talk about the, this little editorial note that the author interjects here. And of course, he's reflecting upon his own time and almost kind of maybe explaining the way things used to be back when Saul was actually going to Samuel for the first time here. And he's explaining some terms here to his contemporary generation who was reading this. They used to be called seers, but now they're called prophets. And a seer is the idea, and that word is actually a very literal translation of the Hebrew. Okay, it'd be a very literal way of bringing it across. A seer, one who sees. Okay, and it emphasizes the aspect of receiving revelation. All right, the fact that they were receiving revelation. He's one who sees. He sees the revelation that God is imparting here. Either visually or figuratively, just as a verbal message in their mind or something. We don't know all the ways that God communicated these, but by the time of the author, the term had been replaced by the term prophet, okay? And prophet really emphasizes the conveying of that message. So, a prophet did not only receive a message from God, he was also responsible to convey that message to others, all right? Again, these are synonyms. And we're just dealing with the nuances here. One deals more with the receiving of that revelation, and then the other, prophet, emphasizes the proclaiming or the conveying of it to others. But again, they're synonyms here, referring to the same, gift and function and so forth. Let me just show you this. As far as we look on in the book of Kings, we see that there, that synonymous aspect is still here. Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you through my servants the prophets. So again, synonymous terms, just maybe emphasizing different aspects of what it meant to be a prophet. Okay, any questions or thoughts there through verse 9? Yes?
Just another way of looking at something. So you were mentioning about the fact that he didn't know about Samuel. Another possibility, and I've seen this with leaders, is that he did know about Samuel, but if he didn't think about it, then it wasn't right. It's his way or the highway. It's a very self-destructive way of
okay.
I've seen that in the military numerous times where even though they know there's a better way of doing it, they didn't think it up, then it's not going to be done.
Sure.
You see that thread that follows through with some of his mistakes later on in life.
It's definitely what we see later. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The possibility he did know about this, so the guy was telling about Samuel.
Sure.
He finally got desperate.
Okay. All right, anyone else? Okay, well, let's go ahead and read verses 10 through 14. Who would like to read those? Yes, Shane.
Then Saul said to his servant, well said, come let us go. So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they went up the hill to the city, they met some young women going out to draw water. And he said to them, is the seer here? And they answered them and said, yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he came to the city. Because there is a sacrifice of people today on the high place. As soon as you come into the city, you will surely find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now therefore go up, for about this time you will find him. So they went up to the city. As they were coming into the city, there was Samuel coming out toward them on his way up.
Okay, thank you. Saul said to his servant, well said, come and let us go. What is this? What does this tell us about Saul? Okay, yeah. He's talking to his servant here. And it's not just a, yeah, okay. It's a, well said. there is this humility, it would seem, conveyed towards his servant. He not only takes his advice, but he also compliments him for it. Well said. So the people, it says, the people have a sacrifice on the high place today. Verse 13, the people will not eat until he comes because he must bless the sacrifice. This is interesting because it gives us a glimpse into not only the role that Samuel was playing, but also the fact that the tabernacle has kind of been fragmented, spread out. The priesthood's in shambles right now. Worship is not happening like it should be. And yet, they're still trying to worship the Lord, okay? And Samuel is being a part of that. and let's just look at this real quick here. The altar spoken of here, where this sacrifice was taking place, was actually probably mentioned. I mean, we don't know this for certain. But in Ramah, if this is in fact Ramah, where his house was, then he returned to his house to Ramah, for his house was there. And there he judged Israel, and he built there an altar to the Lord. I mean, most likely, this is that altar. Okay, we find now that it was at the high place, okay, near where he lived. And this becomes interesting. Again, it's one of those times where you can't help but think back to the time of Moses, where it's kind of transitional. Things are still, God's transitioning things to what he wants them to be. And here, again, we see another time of those transitions. But the law is very clear about these kinds of places. It says, be careful that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every cultic place you see, but in the place which the Lord chooses, in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. So he's very specific that you weren't just supposed to offer sacrifices anywhere, okay? And yet we see them kind of doing that, okay, on different occasions, different places, just, and Samuel's blessing this. Later on, we see Saul is, he forces himself and he makes the sacrifice before Samuel shows up. And, again, before the battle. So these things were happening everywhere. What are we to make of this? It's interesting, again, we could look at the fact that the tabernacle is in shambles. Was God just permitting this because things weren't functioning properly? It is interesting when we look to the time of the kings, we have these kinds of statements made repeatedly about the high places. He walked in all the ways of Asa, this is Jehoshaphat, his father. He did not turn aside from it, doing right in the sight of the Lord. However, the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. Where I've landed on these kinds of statements, and we've talked about this before, about like polygamy, this would be the high places I would put in the category of the things that God permitted, but he didn't necessarily approve of. There were the things that it was, it kind of boils down to this. God works with sinners because that's all he has to work with. And so we could look at the law and see perfection and see what God's absolute will was, and then we see that God is very gracious. Okay. Well, he was a good king. However, the high places were not taken away. In some ways, I see here, even with Samuel, without the tabernacle, God is just permitting them to revert back to offering sacrifices without the priesthood, without the specific place that he had ordained, and so forth. I would put this in the category of what is permitted, but not necessarily approved of. It's good to remember that God specifically said in his statement to Eli that he would first establish a king before he would then reestablish the priesthood. The priesthood would come to him and say, hey, assign me to do whatever. So this would not be restored until the king had been named. Okay, any questions or thoughts through verse 14? We're never told why, but it's always stated as a negative thing that they didn't. You could speculate, was it expediency? Was this just a battle the king didn't want to die for? It's one of those things where it's never really explained why they didn't do this, but it's like, well, he's a good king, except, type thing. Okay, anyone else? All right, who would like to read verses 15 through 17 for us? Yes, go ahead, Marion. Okay, thank you. The statement is made here concerning Saul. This is the revelation made previously before they actually encountered one another. It says, he will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regard for my people because their cry has come to me. It's interesting here. You were told earlier back in chapter 7 that actually all the days of Samuel, the Philistines didn't come into the borders of Israel. So Samuel, again, remember the prayer warrior here. He's the one who defended the nation through prayer, and the Philistines were subdued. They did not come anymore within the borders. The hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. Now, how are we to take this? Because the passage seems to imply that there seems to be some sort of long-standing oppression that's going on here. There's a couple of ways that we could resolve this. Had the Philistines begun to harass them since their request of a king? That's the very reason. We don't know what gap, you know, what kind of gap exists between that request and when Saul, we're not given the time frame there. Presumably it was short. Had the Philistines started to harass them during that time? That is one way to look at it. I'm sure they had. But I think that perhaps they're reaching, this is really referring to an oppression that had been going on much longer. And what they were crying out to them about, I think, is revealed later in chapter 13 when we read this. This is when they're first going to battle with the Philistines under Saul. And it says, now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to fix the hoes. And so what I think that is describing is actually, you know, once Samuel became, you know, the judge, we saw back in, you know, what was it, chapter 7, once he was officially recognized, the nation's repentant, and he enters into his judgeship over the nation, I think this had already taken place, and this describes that whole time since. Even though they were not invading the land, they had removed all the blacksmiths, okay? And so they were having to go down, and here they are getting, you know, charged through the nose to get little things done on this, that, and the other thing, and nobody can stockpile weapons because you don't have people who are skilled in those trades to be able to produce those kinds of weapons. You know, it just stifled them, and for whatever reason, they didn't develop new people for that. So just trying to understand the balance between those two statements. The Philistines didn't come in the borders all the days, and yet we do see that there was a, you know, what do you want to call that? You know, some sort of economic warfare going on here with the between the Philistines and Israel. Okay, well, behold, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people. Just kind of interesting here. I can't help but see the parallels between John the Baptist and, you know, he was, you know, just the whole idea of the one who would anoint the king. He's told beforehand, you're looking for this person. And of course, lo and behold, he arrives and he anoints him king, each in their own unique ways. Okay, who would like to read verses 18 through 21? Anyone? Vince. Now, this doesn't have any of the scary names in here. Dwight did that part, and so you don't have to worry about stumbling over some lengthy, you know, strange names.
Then Saul approached Samuel at the gate and said, please tell me what is in the house. And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, where you shall eat with me today. And in the morning I will let you go, and I will tell you all that is in your mind. And as far as your donkeys which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found for the room. Whom is all that is beside in Israel is enough for you and for all your father's household. And Saul answered and said, I am not a Benjamite, of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family is the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Why then do you speak to me in this way?
Okay. Again, we see very clearly here that Saul has no idea who Samuel is, okay? He walks right up to him, says, you know, show me to the seer. Never met him personally anyway. It says, and for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? What is Samuel saying to Saul? You just won the lottery. Yeah, you get to be king. Now, he doesn't explain that explicitly until a little bit later when he does anoint him towards the end of the chapter, privately. And actually, this account, I call this part one because this account actually goes into chapter 10. It's not really complete until then. But yes, you've won the lottery, and the most treasured, valued things in Israel have just become yours. Okay? You are going to be king. And what is Saul's response? Don't you just love this guy? I mean, he is totally unassuming here. You're talking to me, right? You know, he's looking around behind him thinking, this can't be me. Am I not a Benjamite, the smallest of the tribes of Israel? My father's the family, the least of all the families of the tribes of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way? Again, unassuming. And this unassuming character continues on when he's named publicly. Okay, he's hiding. He doesn't even want to, you know, he doesn't even want to come forward and embrace it here. So everything that we've seen about this guy is endearing. We get to the end, we're like, we love this guy. This is the perfect choice to be king. And, you know, it's speaking as a man. It's speaking as a man. Ultimately, it's like, I think the author is painting this picture that we say, yeah, we love this guy. And he gets the People's Choice Award even among us. And yet, as the book goes on, God says, nope, I've rejected him. I'm going to choose a man after my own heart, okay? He might get the People's Choice Award, but at the end of the day, God sees deeper, and, you know, he wants some, well, we'll get into it, that deeper characteristic. Again, I don't want to get ahead of our author. So he's going to reveal what it means to be a man after God's own heart. There is a pinnacle illustration of this. Okay. Any questions or thoughts through 21? Yes. Yes. Here's the one you wanted. That's right. Yes. Yes. Sure. Mm-hmm. This is the best that democracy can produce. Okay. Well, verses 22 through 24. Who would like to read those? Yes, Mom. Okay, so we see that his privileged status begins immediately, okay? Immediately, he is set at the head of the table of all those who are invited, and the cook gives him a choice piece of meat, the leg. You know, who is the leg usually reserved for? Yeah, now, the right leg, this could be the left. There are two legs on a cow. But it just shows you that the leg was to some degree, I mean, it was given to the priest. And so there was, you know, kind of this, you know, well, I mean, it's special. It's given to God. Okay. That's the part that we give to God. So if we give the right leg to God, let's give the left leg to the king. You know, this is a very choice portion of meat, at least in God's eyes. He's the one who selected it. It wasn't to Eli's sons. You know, our feelings as the reader is who could possibly deserve this more? I mean, you get to this point and you think, this guy is quite lovable. Okay, he's quite lovable. And what's not to like about him? He's the perfect choice to be king. And according to this chapter, is Saul a great guy? Absolutely. Will he be a great king? Well, that remains to be seen. And as we go on, we see, no, he is not going to be a great king. In fact, what is so shocking about Saul, I mean, it's kind of interesting. You know, I think people, you know, it's like, well, Saul was good for about, you know, half his kingship. Saul was good. You could count it in the months. Okay. By the time we get, I believe it's to chapter 13, there are already major signs that Saul is rejecting the Lord. Okay. There are some major signs that he's on the wrong path. He's not a man after God's own heart. And so the only one to fall faster than Saul in Scripture, I think, really is Satan. Satan fell faster, but I think Saul is a close second. The indication of this came very early. All these things are great things that we've read about Saul in this chapter, but they do not necessarily indicate a man after God's own heart. And the author will reveal what makes for a man after God's own heart, but again, that's for a later study. We don't want to get ahead of that. We're still want to dwell back here with, oh, isn't he so great? Isn't he so wonderful? Chapter 10 and 11, we will see a similar portrait of him as we go along. We'll go ahead and quit there, because actually verses 25 through 27 introduce chapter 10 and the dialogue that takes place there. Any questions or thoughts through verse 24? Oh, okay, sure. Well, good. Okay. Well, amen. Yes.
There's an interesting tension all the way through here. I fully concur with everything you're saying as far as this is really the people's choice. It's God's permissive will.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's interesting as you get into chapter 13 where in verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like he says, you know, this is all on your head. It is still human responsibility here.
Sure.
And it was in here. And so I think you have that tension, you know, between sovereignty, God's permissive will.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, theoretically, God says, could have been yours, and yet we know it belongs to the tribe of Judah,
mm-hmm.
not to the tribe of Benjamin. So, you know, in that sense, it has to go to Judah.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of tensions there, you know, that I see.
Right.
But I see it came down to there is human responsibility here. It's not like Saul could say, well, you know what? It wasn't really my fault. I didn't even want to be king. It's like, no, you're still responsible.
Yeah. I mean, it is a matter of the heart. You know, David proved to be a man after God's own heart. And well, I don't want to get into that. I don't want to, because, yes, you're right. It does come down to human responsibility. And I think that's very evident in what constitutes a man after God's own heart. Anyone else?
Would that show where your free will kind of ties into that?
Okay.
Well, Saul's taking his own free will.
Well, yeah, that's what Dwight was bringing out. Absolutely. Yeah. Saul's the one who jumped off the cliff. God didn't make him jump. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Okay. Well, let's go ahead and take some prayer requests.